Summer, who was always exclaiming, "Isn't that great?" Only she made it almost rhyme with bright. So when my friend would call with her latest good news, always presented humbly like some born-again Christian Miss America contest, I'd say, "Isn't that great, huh? Isn't that great?" She would say, "You are so supportive. Some of my other friends are having trouble with this." I'd say, "How could I not be supportive? It's just so darn great." But I always wanted to ask, "Could I have the names and numbers of some of your other friends?" Sometimes I would get off the phone and cry. After a while, I started asking people for help. One person reminded me of what Jean Rhys once wrote, that all of us writers are little rivers running into one lake, that what is good for one is good for all, that we all collectively share in one another's success and acclaim. I said, "You are a very, very angry person." My therapist said that jealousy is a secondary emotion, that it is born out of feeling excluded and deprived, and that if I worked on those age-old feelings, I would probably break through the jealousy. I tried to get her to give me a prescription for Prozac, but she said that this other writer was in my life to help me heal my past. She said this writer had helped bring up a lifetime's worth of feeling that other families were happier than ours, that other families had some owner's manual to go by. She said it was once again that business of comparing my insides to other people's outsides. She said to go ahead and feel the feelings. I did. It felt like shit. My friend, the writer I was so jealous of, would call and say, like some southern belle, "I just don't know why God has given me so much money this year." And I would do my lamas for a moment and say, "Isn't that great?" I have never felt like such a loser in my life. I called a very wise writer I know who's been in Alcoholics Anonymous for years, who spends half his time helping others get sober. I asked him what he would tell a newcomer who was in the throes of insanity or, say, hypothetically, jealousy. "I just listen," he said. "They all tell me these incredibly long, self-important, convoluted stories, and then I say one of three things. I say, uh-huh. I say, hmm. I say, too bad." I laughed. Then I started telling him about this awful friend I had who was doing so well. He was silent for a moment. Then he said, uh-huh. Next, I talked to my slightly overweight, alcoholic, gay, Catholic priest friend. I said, "Do you get jealous?" He said, "When I see a man my own age in great shape, and I feel all conflicted, wishing I were that thin, and yet at the same time wanting to lick him, is that jealousy or is that appreciation?" It was hard to get anyone to say anything that would make the jealousy go away or change into something else. I felt like the wicked stepsister in a fairy tale. I told another friend, and she read me some lines by a Lakota Sioux, "Sometimes I go about pitying myself, and all the while I am being carried on great winds across the sky." "That is so beautiful," I said. "And I am so mentally ill." Those lines, however, offered the beginning of a solution. They made the first tiny crack in my prison wall. I was waiting for the kind of solution where God reaches down and touches you with his magic wand, and all of a sudden I would be fixed, like a broken toaster oven. But this was not the way it happened. Instead, I got one angstrom unit better day by day. Another piece of the solution came when a poem by Clive James, called "The Book of My Enemy Has Been Remaindered," appeared one Sunday in the New York Times Book Review. "The book of my enemy has been remaindered," it begins, "and I am pleased." It helped more than words can say. Oh, what blessed relief for someone to be as jealous and spiteful as me and to make those feelings funny. I called everyone whose advice I had sought and read it to them. Everybody howled with recognition. Yet another piece of the solution dropped into place when my friend Judy said that the problem was trying to stop the jealousy and competitiveness, and that the main thing was not to let it fuel my self-loathing. She said it was nuts for me to try to be happy for this other writer. I cannot tell you how much this helped. I was raised in a culture that promotes this competitiveness, this insatiability, this fantasy of needing hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, and then, in the next breath, shames you for any feelings of longing or envy or fear that it will always be someone else's turn. I was only doing what I had been groomed to do. So, I started getting my sense of humor back. I started telling myself that if you want to know how God feels about money, look at whom she gives it to. This cheered me up no end. Even though my closest friends have lots of money, I told myself that historically when people do too well too quickly, they are a Greek tragedy waiting to happen. I, who did not do too well too quickly and who was, in fact, not doing too well over time, was actually in the catbird seat. I was not going to end up the cocky heroine in an ugly hubris drama. This is not to be underestimated. My nerves are shot as it is. The last thing I need would be an onslaught of thunder and silent screams with cymbals, fangs, winds pushing forest fires across the land. I mean, who needs it? Then, I started to write about my envy. I got to look in some cold, dark corners, see what was there, shine a little light on what we all have in common. Sometimes this human stuff is slimy and pathetic. Jealousy especially so. But better to feel it and talk about it and walk through it than to spend a lifetime being silently poisoned. Now I felt like I was getting somewhere. After all those weeks of emotionally swimming the English Channel, cold and afraid, then I saw a documentary on TV about a couple with AIDS. And all the pieces of the solution finally came together. There was a lot of footage in that movie of ravaged bodies. The sorts of bodies we usually recoil from. One of the men in the couple had an emaciated back entirely purple with Kaposi's. But once you, the viewer, got to know the spirit inside, you could see the beauty of that sick person lying under the mounds of quilts that friends had made. You could see the amazing fortitude of people going through horror with grace, looking right into the pit and seeing that this is what you've got, this disease. Or maybe even this jealousy. So you do as well as you can with it. And this ravaged body or wounded psyche can and should still be cared for as softly and tenderly as possible. The more I wrote about it and the more I thought of the movie, the angrier I got at how often this writer friend mentioned her money to me, because that summer Sam and I had almost none and she knew this. I kept writing about my childhood, about how often I had longed for what other girls had, and for what other families seemed to be about. I taped Hillel's line to the wall by my desk. I get up, I walk, I fall down. Meanwhile, I keep dancing. The way I dance is by writing. So I wrote about trying to pay closer attention to the world, about taking things less seriously, moving more slowly, stepping outside more often. Eventually, what I was writing got funnier, and compassion broke through for me and also for my writer friend. And at this point, I told her, as kindly as possible, that I needed a sabbatical from our friendship. Life really is so short. And finally, I felt that my jealousy and I were strangely beautiful, like the men in the AIDS movie. Doing the dance of the transformed self, dancing like an old long-legged bird. Part 3. Help along the way. Index cards. I like to think that Henry James said his classic line, "A writer is someone on whom nothing is lost," while looking for his glasses. And that they were on top of his head. We have so much to remember these days. So we make all these lists, filled with hope that they will remind us of all the important things to do and buy and mail, all the important calls we need to make, all the ideas we have for short stories or articles. And yet, by the time you get around to everything on any one list, you're already behind on another. Still, I believe in lists, and I believe in taking notes. And I believe in index cards for doing both. I have index cards and pens all over the house. by the bed, in the bathroom, in the kitchen, by the phones, and I have them in the glove compartment of my car. I carry one with me in my back pocket when I take my dog for a walk. In fact, I carry it folded lengthwise, if you need to know, so that, God forbid, I won't look bulky. You may want to consider doing the same. I don't even know you, but I bet you have enough on your mind without having to worry about whether or not you look bulky. So, whenever I'm leaving the house without my purse, in which there are actual notepads, let alone index cards, I fold an index card lengthwise in half, stick it in my back pocket along with a pen, and head out, knowing that if I have an idea or see something lovely or strange or for any reason worth remembering, I will be able to jot down a couple of words to remind me of it. Sometimes if I overhear or think of an exact line of dialogue or a transition, I write it down verbatim. I stick the card back in my pocket. I might be walking along the salt marsh or out at Phoenix Lake or in the express line at Safeway, and suddenly I hear something wonderful that makes me want to smile or snap my fingers, as if it has just come back to me, and I take out my index card and scribble it down. I have an index card beside me right now on which I scribbled, "Pammy, Demi Moore." Those words capture an entire movie for me, of one particular day last year, 6 months before Pammy died. We were outside in her garden. The sky was blue and cloudless, everything was in bloom, and she wore a little lavender cotton cap. She was doing very well that day, except that she was dying. My father's oncologist once assured him, "You're a very, very healthy 55-year-old man, except, of course, for the brain cancer." We were lying on chaise longue in T-shirts and shorts, eating miniature Halloween chocolate bars. Sam was pulling Pammy's 2-year-old daughter, Rebecca, around the garden in a little red wagon. "I'm a little depressed," Pammy said. One day, not long before, she had said that all she had to do to get really, really depressed was to think of Rebecca, and all she had to do to get really, really joyful was to think of Rebecca. "I'm actually quite depressed," she said. "I don't see why. What's the silver lining here I can't seem to remember today?" "The silver lining is that you're not going to have to see any more naked pregnant pictures of Demi Moore." She looked at me for a moment with real wonder. "God," she said, "that's a lot. I hadn't even thought of that." And she was very funny again for the rest of the day, happy to be with the children and me. It was such a rare scene that you would think I would remember it forever. I used to think that if something was important enough, I'd remember it until I got home, where I could simply write it down in my notebook like some normal functioning member of society. But then I wouldn't. I'd get home, remembering that I had thought of or heard the perfect image or lines to get my characters from the party in the old house on the hill to their first day on the new job, or to their childhood playhouse or wherever it was that they seemed to think they were supposed to be next. And I'd stand there, trying to see it, the way you try to remember a dream, where you squint and it's right there on the tip of your psychic tongue, but you can't get it back. The image is gone. That is one of the worst feelings I can think of, to have had a wonderful moment or insight or vision or phrase, to know you had it and then to lose it. So now I use index cards. One of the things that happens when you give yourself permission to start writing is that you start thinking like a writer. You start seeing everything as material. Sometimes you'll sit down or go walking and your thoughts will be on one aspect of your work, or one idea you have for a small scene, or a general portrait of one of the characters you're working with. Or you'll just be completely blocked and hopeless and wondering why you shouldn't just go into the kitchen and have a nice glass of warm gin straight out of the cat dish. And then, unbidden, seemingly out of nowhere, a thought or image arise. Some will float into your head like goldfish, lovely, bright orange and weightless, and you follow them like a child looking at an aquarium that was thought to be without fish. Others will step out of the shadows like Boo Radley and make you catch your breath or take a step backward. They're often so rich, these unbidden thoughts, and so clear that they feel indelible. But I say write them all down anyway. Now, I have a number of writer friends who do not take notes out there in the world, who say it's like not taking notes in class, but listening instead. I think that if you have the kind of mind that retains important and creative thoughts, that is, if your mind still works, you're very lucky, and you should not be surprised if the rest of us do not want to be around you. I actually have one writer friend, whom I think I will probably be getting rid of soon, who said to me recently that if you don't remember it when you get home, it probably wasn't that important. And I felt 8 years old again, with something important to say that had suddenly hopped down one of the rabbit holes in my mind, while an adult nearby was saying priggishly, "Well, it must not have been very important then." So, you have to decide how you feel about this. You may have a perfectly good memory and be able to remember 3 hours later what you came up with while walking on the mountain or waiting at the dentist's. And then again, you may not. If it feels natural, if it helps you to remember, take notes. It's not cheating. It doesn't say anything about your character. If your mind is perhaps the merest bit disorganized, it probably just means that you've lost a little ground. It may be all those drugs you took when you were younger, all that non-habit-forming marijuana that you smoked on a daily basis for 20 years. It may be that you've had children. When a child comes out of your body, it arrives with about a fifth of your brain clutched in its little hand, like those babies born clutching IUDs. So, for any number of reasons, it's only fair to let yourself take notes. My index card life is not efficient or well-organized. Hostile, aggressive students insist on asking what I do with all my index cards, and all I can say is that I have them. I took notes on them, and the act of having written something down gives me a 50-50 shot at having it filed away now in my memory. If I'm working on a book or an article, and I've taken some notes on index cards, I keep them with that material, paperclip them to a page of rough draft where that idea or image might bring things to life. Or I stack them on my desk along with the pages for the particular chapter or article I'm working on, so I can look at them. When I get stuck or lost or the jungle drums start beating in my head, proclaiming that the jig is about to be up and I don't know what I'm doing and the well is run dry, I'll look through my index cards. I try to see if there's a short assignment on any one of them that will get me writing again, give me a small sense of confidence, help me put down one damn word after another, which is, let's face it, what writing finally boils down to. There are index cards on my desk that record things I thought of or saw or remembered or overheard in the last week or so. There are index cards from a couple of years ago. There's even one index card from 6 or 7 years ago, when I was walking along the salt marsh between Sausalito and Mill Valley. Bicyclists were passing me on both sides, and I wasn't paying much attention, until suddenly a woman rode past wearing some sort of lemon perfume. And in a split second, I was in one of those Proustian olfactory flashbacks, 25 or so years before, in the kitchen of one of my aunts, with her many children, my cousins, on a hot summer's day. I was the eldest, at 8 or so, and my aunt and uncle had just gotten divorced. She was sad and worried. And I think to soothe herself and help her wounded ego, she had done a little retail therapy. She'd gone to the store and spent several dollars on a lemonade-making contraption. Of course, it goes without saying that to make lemonade, all you need is a pitcher, a lemon juice squeezer, ice cubes, water, lemons, and sugar. That's all. Oh, and a long spoon. But my aunt was a little depressed. And this lemonade-making thing, it must have seemed like something that would be fun and would maybe hydrate her life a little, filling her desiccated spirit with nice, cool, sweet lemonade. The contraption consisted of a glass pitcher with a lemon squeezer that fit on top and that had a holding tank for the lemon juice. What you did was to fill the pitcher with water and ice cubes and sugar, then put the squeezer with its holding tank on top. Squeeze a bunch of lemons, then pour the lemon juice from the holding tank into the pitcher. Finally, you got your long spoon and stirred. The lemon gouge and seeds stayed on top in the juice squeezer. The whole thing was very efficient, but if you thought about it too long, totally stupid, too. So, There we were in the kitchen, the five cousins and me, crowded around her at the sink as she proudly made us lemonade. She put the cold water in the pitcher, added ice cubes, lots of sugar, put the juicer lid on top, squeezed a dozen lemons, and then began to take glasses down from the cupboards. "Wait!" We older ones wanted to cry out. "You haven't poured in the lemon juice. Stop! Mistakes are being made!" But she got out jelly glasses, plastic glasses, a couple of brilliant aluminum glasses, and poured seven servings. There we were, six anxious black belt codependents, unable to breathe, with a longing for everything to be okay and for her not to feel sad anymore. She raised her glass to us as a toast, and we all took sips of our sugary ice water. And my aunt's hands were so lemony from cutting and squeezing all those lemons that she must have tasted lemon. We all stared at her helplessly as we drank our sugar water, then smiled and raised our glasses like we were doing a soft drink commercial and held them out for more. I perfectly remembered, there on the salt marsh, the crummy linoleum on my aunt's kitchen floor, graying beige speckled with black, and how it wore away to all black near the sink, and how at its most worn place rotted wood showed through, and how all those cousins, some so young they must have thought ice-cold sugar water was about as good as the getting got, stood at the sink with us older kids in a ring around my aunt, and how close I felt to them all, how much a part of the wheel. It touches me so deeply, the poignancy of the crummy linoleum, of my aunt's pain and her pride in her lemonade-making machine, of all the ways in which we try to comfort ourselves, of her wanting to make us better lemonade, of us wanting to make her better, the enthusiasm with which we drank and held out our glasses as if we were hoisting steins at Oktoberfest. And I hadn't remembered any of this in 25 years. Now, maybe I'm not going to use it anywhere. All the index card says is the lemonade-making thing. But it's like a snippet from a movie, a vignette of a family in pain, managing to survive. One of those rare moments when people's hearts are opened by disappointment and love, and for just a few minutes, against all odds, everything is more or less okay. Sometimes I'll be driving along, and all of a sudden words form in my mind that solve some technical problem for me. I may have been trying all morning long to show that time has been passing for my characters, without resorting to old movie techniques where leaves of a calendar blow out the window or the hands of a clock spin. These techniques do not translate well to the written word. It's a wonderful feeling when you're reading something by someone else and the writer has aged exactly the right detail so that you know the story is picking up again sometime later. Sometimes the seasons change, or children start school, or beards grow long, or pets go gray. But sometimes in your own writing, you can't find the way to make time pass invisibly, and you will not be aided in this by sitting at your desk staring bitterly at your words, trying to will it to happen. Instead, all of a sudden, when you're wrestling with the dog or paying the electric bill, you might look up and know that something is coming to you that might really matter, only you can't quite reel it in. It's like watching someone on a ventilator rise again and again to the surface, like a trapped fish. And you stay with the person, and sometimes he or she blinks awake. And so, if you hold some space open, an image may come to you. Then, for goodness sakes, jot it down. I have an index card here on which is written, 6 years later, the memory of the raw fish cubes continue to haunt her, which I thought might make a great transitional line. But I have so far not found a place for it. You're welcome to use it, if you can. I eventually throw away a lot of my index cards, either because I use what's on them in a paragraph somewhere or because it turns out that the thought wasn't all that interesting. Many index cards on which I write in the middle of the night tend to be incoherent, like some incredibly bright math major thinking about oranges or truth while on LSD. Some contain great quotes that I share with my students, although I unfortunately often forget to write down whose quote it is, like this one, for instance. What lies behind us and what lies before us are tiny matters compared to what lies within us. Now, I'm almost positive Ralph Waldo Emerson said this, but with my luck, some critic will point out that it was really Georgette Mosbacher. Who was it that said a critic is someone who comes onto the battlefield after the battle is over and shoots the wounded? I have it written on an index card somewhere. Other cards just sort of live with me in little piles and drifts. My son will probably have to deal with them someday after my death. They are my equivalent of all the cats that those nutty Bouvier ants own. But my cards do not smell or shed or go wee-wee on the floors, and I think Sam should be aware that he is getting off easy. Most of them will not make much sense to him. There are many with just one or two words on them that would have reminded me of entire scenes and empires, but he will have to stand there scratching his head. But he will also find some dated in the early 90s, and they will contain complete stories about how he blew me away, how he made me shake my head with wonder and a kind of relief, like this one, dated 9/17/93. Sam and I walked Bill and Adair up to their car after dinner. Crisp, cold, starry night. Bill, holding Sam, inhaled deeply. "Doesn't it smell wonderful, Sam?" he said. Sam inhaled deeply, too, like he was smelling a delicious meal. Looked off into space and said, "It smells like moon." Now that memory won't be lost. I'm not sure if I will use it in my writing. Actually, I guess I just did. But I know it won't be lost. Nor will the details of an early morning the two of us spent recently in an emergency room, where Sam was having his first asthma attack. We were both afraid and sad and did not quite know what was going on, but Sam was hooked up to a nebulizer with a mask over his mouth and nose, and I was sitting beside him on his bed, wishing I had thought to grab a toy as we left the house. So I looked inside my purse and managed to come up with a tiny box of crayons from a restaurant and two used index cards. One contained a shopping list, the other a brief description of the sky. I drew a terrible giant on the blank side of each card. Sam, sucking away at his mask, watched me with fear. Next, I poked holes in each of the giant's right hands and stuck tongue depressors through the holes. Then I staged a vigorous, clicking sword fight. Sam's eyes grew wide and he smiled. After a long while, he could breathe again freely, and we were told we could go home. But before we did, I dismantled the giants, stuck the cards with the shopping list in my back pocket, and on the back of the other, scribbled down this story. Calling around. There are an enormous number of people out there with invaluable information to share with you, and all you have to do is pick up the phone. They love it when you do, just as you love it when people ask if they can pick your brain about something you happen to know a great deal about, or, as in my case, have a number of impassioned opinions on. Say you happen to know a lot about knots or penguins or cheeses, and the right person asks you to tell him or her everything you know. What a wonderful and rare experience. Usually what happens in real life is that people ask you questions you can't remember the answer to, like what you came into the kitchen to get, or what happened on the 4th of July in 1776, and you sit there thinking, "God, I knew that. It's right there on the tip of my tongue. Let's see. Okay, wait, the Constitution? No, wait, shit, I used to know." When you do actually know a bit about something, it is such a pleasure to be asked a lot of questions about it. This is one great reason to call around. Another is that if you make the phone call while sitting at your computer, you can consider it part of that day's work. It's not shirking. Being a writer guarantees that you will spend too much time alone, and that, as a result, your mind will begin to warp. If you are in a small workspace, your brain will begin breathing and contracting like the sets in Dr. Caligari. You may begin showing signs of schizophrenia. Like you'll stare at the word schizophrenia so long that it will start to look wrong and you won't be able to find it in the dictionary, and you'll start to think you made it up, and then you'll notice a tiny mouth sore, one of those tiny canker sores that your tongue can't keep away from, that feels like a wound the size of a marble, but when you go to study it in the mirror, you see that it is a white spot roughly as big as a pinhead. Still, the next thing you know, because you are spending too much time alone, you are convinced that you have mouth cancer, just like good old Sigmund, and you know instantly that doctors will have to cut away half of your jaw, trying to save your miserable, obsessive-compulsive head from being cannibalized by the cancer, and you'll have to go around wearing a hood over your entire face, and no one will ever want to kiss you again, not that they ever really did. I don't think there's anything wrong with this way of thinking, only that it is ultimately not all that productive. So you might as well try to get something done. And it's better if contact with another human being is involved. One thing I know for sure about raising children is that every single day, a kid needs discipline. So it's useful to give yourself a minimum quota of 300 words a day. But also every single day, a kid needs a break. So think of calling around as giving yourself a break. The truth is that there are simply going to be times when you can't go forward in your work until you find out something about the place you grew up, when it was still a railroad town, or what the early stages of shingles are like, or what your character would actually experience the first week of beauty school. So figure out who would have this information and give that person a call. It's best if you can think of someone who's witty and articulate so you can steal all of his or her material. Also, of course, it's just more interesting to be on the phone with someone who's sort of keen. But these qualities are not absolutely necessary because you may just be looking for one piece of information or even just one word, and you do not need a whole lot of background or humor to go with it. And it may also turn out that in searching for this one bit of information, something else will turn up that you absolutely could not have known would be out there waiting for you. For instance, when I was writing my second novel, I got to the part where the man comes over for his first date with the woman and brings with him a bottle of champagne. He removes the foil. We get to see his hands, which are beautiful, long and broad with white moons on his big square fingernails, so lovely that they almost make up for the fact that he is wearing a yellow polyester shirt. Also, it is in his favor that he has brought along a nice bottle of champagne. The woman loves to drink. So, the man has peeled the foil away and then begins to untwist and remove that wire thing that covers all champagne corks. Now, I've always thought of that wire thing, that little helmet, as the wire thing. And that is how everyone I've ever known refers to it. Honey, will you take the wire thing off the champagne? I just have my nails done. Oh, look, Skippy's playing with that little wire thing. I hope she doesn't cut her little lips on it. But it must have a name, right? I mean, boxes of them don't just arrive at wineries, 500-count wire things. They have to have a label. So I called the Christian Brothers Winery, whose vineyard is near the Russian River. I got a busy signal. I really did. So I sat there staring off into space. I watched the movie in my mind of the many times I'd passed those vineyards and remembered how, especially in the early fall, a vineyard is about as voluptuous a place as you can find on earth. The sense of lushness and abundance, the fullness of the clumps of grapes that hang mammarian and give off an ancient autumnal smell, semi-protected from the sun by their leaves. The grapes are so incredibly beautiful that you can't help but be thrilled. If you only see someone's profit or that in another month there will be rotten fruit all over the ground, someone has gotten inside your brain and really fucked you up. All you need to get well so you can see again, see that the grapes almost seem to glow with a light dusting of some sort of powdery residue like an incredibly light snowfall, almost as if they're covered with their own confectioner's sugar. I wrote all this down and then dialed the winery again. The line was still busy. Right when I hung up, a friend called and wanted to describe his latest emotional catastrophes, but I said, no, talk to me about grapes. I read him what I'd written and he said, yes, they really are that lovely. They do almost glow. Mother Nature wants animals to be mesmerized, hypnotized by the beauty of the fruit, so they'll eat it, shit the pit somewhere else, and make her some more. So I wrote this down on the index card, too, and I felt so happy about that card, even though I was unable to use it until just now. I finally got through to the winery's receptionist and told her what I needed. She said she always just thought of it as the wire thing, too, so she transferred me to a 2,000-year-old monk. Or at least this is how he sounded, faint, reedy, out of breath, like Noah after a brisk walk. And he was so glad I'd called. He actually said so. And he sounded like he was. I have secretly believed ever since that he had somehow stayed alive just long enough to be there for my phone call, and that after he answered my question, he hung up, smiled, and keeled over. "Ah," he said when I told him what I was after. "That would be the wire hood." What a full day. I had a description of vineyards that could turn out to be a perfect setting for a scene somewhere down the line. I got to think about how good Mother Nature is at getting her business done. And I got to write that my character untwisted and removed the wire hood before popping the cork. I can't tell you how many people have come up to me in the 10 years since that book came out and said that they love knowing the word for what they'd always referred to as the wire thing. Okay, the truth is, I can tell you how many people. 3. But 3 people who seemed genuinely pleased to have found out something they'd wondered about. Okay, let's be honest. 2 real people and my mother. Not that my mother is not a real person, but whenever I show her a copy of my latest book, she gets sort of quiet and teary, and you can tell that what she's feeling is, "Oh, honey, did you make that yourself?" Like it's my handprint in clay. Which I suppose in many ways it is. Writing groups. So much of writing is about sitting down and doing it every day. And so much of it is about getting into the custom of taking in everything that comes along, seeing it all as grist for the mill. This can be a very comforting habit, like biting your nails. Instead of being scared all the time, you detach, watch what goes on, and consider it creatively. Instead of feeling panicked by those lowlifes on the subway, you notice all the details of their clothes and bearing and speech. Maybe you never quite get to the point where you think, "Ah, so that's what a gun looks like from this end," but you take in all you can, as a child would, without the atmospheric smog of most grown-up vision. And all the while, you are writing away, editing, revising, trying new leads, new endings, until finally, at some point, you want some feedback. You want other people to read it. You want to know what they think. We are social animals, and we are trying to communicate with others of our species. And up to now, you've been alone in a hole getting your work done. You have no idea whether it sings to anyone but you. You wouldn't spend a month on an oil painting and then mummify it. You would hang it where people could see it. So the thought of a writing class or a writing conference may cross your mind. Blooming writers really do not know what to expect when they sign up for a workshop or a creative writing class. Some want to learn to write or to write better. Others have been writing a great deal for a long time and want some feedback. These are realistic goals. A certain kind of person finds writing classes and workshops to be like camp and just wants to hang out with all these other people, maybe with a writer he or she respects, to get and give response and encouragement and to hear how other people tell their stories. Some people want other people with whom to share the disappointments and rejection letters and doldrums. A lot of people like to work on other people's writing because it helps them figure out what they themselves love in the written word, as well as what doesn't work for them. And others want feedback from people who aren't quite friends or editors, but who will be realistic and honest and helpful. But a lot of people come to my workshops or classes secretly hoping that I will have read their submission and absolutely flipped. I will take them aside after class and tell them that all the story needs is for them to put a little spin on the ending, maybe shorten the scene with Cammy and the ducks, and that then we'll send it off to my agent or the New Yorker. Maybe we'll just send it straight to Sonny Mehta. We'll fax it to Sonny. He would want it that way. But I tell them that this is probably not going to happen. Every so often at a writing conference, people get taken aside by wonderful writers who love their story and who help them in some pivotal way. Every so often during one of my workshops, I'll take someone aside and say, "You're very good. Work on this another 6 months and then give me a call, and we'll take it from there." But this is rare. Mostly what I do is listen and encourage and tell people what writing is like for me on a daily basis and what helps me and what doesn't. I tell people all the things I like about their piece, how wonderful the atmosphere is, for instance, in the language, and also point out where they got all tangled up in their own process. We, the other students and I, can be like a doctor to whom you take your work for a general checkup. We can give you a place to show up and a little benevolent pressure, which we hope will help you finish stories and sections. We can give you some respect, because we know what it takes. But be warned that you may feel as though you have put your head in the lion's mouth. Creative writing classes and ongoing workshops tend to be gentler than conferences. But in all of these situations, you may find yourself sitting around a table with a number of other writers who feel morally and aesthetically compelled to rip your story to shreds. At best, they will say that the story would work better if you rewrote it in the past tense, unless it is already in the past tense, in which case they will suggest the present, or that you should try writing in the first person, or if it is in the first person, in the third. At worst, they will suggest that you have no visible talent whatsoever and should not bother writing anything ever again, even your name. I've taught at writing conferences where students have come to me crying because the famous writer who critiqued their work that day had savaged it. I've taught at conferences where the students have been devastated by the harshness of other participants' comments, where it felt to them like the Lord of the Flies writing conference. Last summer, for instance, I was in the classroom at a huge and prestigious conference when things got completely out of hand. I sat with that day's 20 students and listened to one of them read a few pages of his work. He had not been writing for very long. It was experimental, with a lot of bad dialect and not very good. The other students had been given his story beforehand to mark up, and when he was done, they gave him their comments. They mentioned things they liked, things they thought he had done well, moments here and there that worked. They said that the dialect had gotten in the way, but that there was a great deal of heart and emotion in the story that had moved them. I thought that what they said was true, if perhaps somewhat effusive. So I said a few encouraging things, too, and pointed out a few passages that didn't ring true, recommended ways to pick up the pace, and rather gently suggested that it needed some work. The author asked a few specific questions and was given some good suggestions. Then a young woman who had been silent raised her hand. "Am I crazy?" she implored. "Am I losing my mind? Am I the only person here who doesn't think it worked at all? Did anyone actually think there was one believable character, one meaningful image?" And she went on, while the rest of us stared at her entranced, as if frozen in cobra hypnosis. Much of what she said was true. She looked at me when she was finished, fevered and imploring. I looked back at her. I tried to figure out what to do. There was a silence. "Should he give up altogether?" I asked. "I think people are patronizing him. He's not going to get better if people don't tell the truth," she wailed. "But what you think is the truth is just your opinion." The author of the story scanned the ceiling, as if he had heard the drone of approaching mosquitoes. The rest of the class stared at me with a sort of wired expectation. Part of me understood how the young woman felt. It had taken a lot of courage for her to speak up. And part of me wanted to tear a leg off the table and wave it at her threateningly. I knew she was a much better writer than he, because almost everyone was. I tried to breathe and to remember what unpublished writers need and why they come to these writing conferences. They need attention. They need someone to respond to their work as honestly as possible, but without being abusive or diminishing. So in my comments, I focused on the fact that the author had tried something so difficult had taken such a risk. I told him that the best possible thing was to shoot high and make mistakes, and that when he was old or dying, he was almost certainly not going to say, "God, I'm so glad I took so few risks. I'm so glad I kept shooting so low." I told him to plow ahead, ride it one more time, and then get to work on something else. I told the young woman in front of the class that it had taken guts to say what she had said. Later, she sought me out and asked if I thought she was a monster. I told her I thought she'd been very honest and that this was totally commendable. But you don't always have to chop with the sword of truth. You can point with it, too. Long after the conference was over, I found a poem by Bill Holm, which I wanted to send to the young man. But I no longer had his address. It is called August in Waterton, Alberta. Above me, wind does its best to blow leaves off the aspen tree a month too soon. No use, wind. All you succeed in doing is making music, the noise of failure growing beautiful. Be aware that some conferences and writing programs can be cutthroat and competitive, and you may not need or be ready for the fiercest possible critique of your work. But if you do need feedback, encouragement, benevolent pressure, and the company of other writers, you may want to consider starting a writing group. I've had students who met in a class of mine and who then started getting together in groups of three or four every third Thursday or the last Sunday of the month or whenever, and who've been doing this for years now. The fact that they're going to meet means that they have to get a certain amount of work finished. Also, an occupational hazard of writing is that you'll have bad days. You feel not only totally alone, but also that everyone else is at a party. But if you talk to other people who write, you remember that this feeling is part of the process, that it's inevitable. Writers tend to be so paranoid about talking about their work because no one, including us, really understands how it works. But it can help a great deal if you have someone you can call when you need a pep talk, someone you've learned to trust, someone who is honest and generous and who won't jinx you. When you're feeling low, you won't want anyone even to joke that you may be in some kind of astrological strike zone where you'll be for the next 7 years. On a bad day, you also don't need a lot of advice. You just need a little empathy and affirmation. You need to feel once again that other people have confidence in you. The members of your writing group can offer just that. So, how do you start one? One way is to join a creative writing class and to ask the people whose work you most love and with whom you may have some rapport if they want to begin meeting once a month, to hear and support each other's work, gossip a little, and talk about writing in general. They may say no. Then you can call Jack Kevorkian and see if he can squeeze you in. Or you can keep trying until you find two or three people who do want to see what a group would be like. Some of my students have put ads on bulletin boards and in small newspapers, announcing the formation of a writing group for beginning writers or for writers with novels they are trying to get published. Many, if not most, of these people have ended up with functioning groups that bring them a great deal of pleasure and support. My New Age friends claim that they've started groups by just putting it out to the universe. Now, I love this sort of talk. I always picture the universe hearing the call and flipping breathlessly through its little Rolodex because these friends have all ended up in flourishing writing groups. So, who's to say? There are four people, three women and one man, who met in one of my classes and who have now been meeting as a group for 4 years. I see them together in bookstores or cafes where they sit at tables with wine or coffee and go over each other's work, offer criticism and encouragement, ask questions, and figure out where to go next. They do not actually edit each other's drafts, which is something we'll talk about in the next chapter, but they listen to each other's work and help each other to keep at it. Sometimes they'll drop in on one of my classes, like the seniors dropping by freshman basketball practice. They end up giving the new students rousing pep talks about how great it is to be part of a writing group, how much they've come to care for one another, how it helps them get their work done. They've gone from being four tense, slightly conceited, lonely people who wanted to write to one of those weird little families we fashion out of whoever's around us. They're very tender with one another. They all look a lot less slick and cool than they did when they were in my class, because helping each other has made their hearts get bigger. A big heart is both a clunky and a delicate thing. It doesn't protect itself, and it doesn't hide. It stands out, like a baby's fontanelle, where you can see the soul pulse through. You can see this pulse in them now. All four of them are excellent writers, but only one of them has been published at all, and that was just one article. But you know what? They love each other. They still look forward to their meetings after all these years. They are better writers and better people because of their work with each other. Almost always, at least one of them is well and able to help, while someone else is always on the verge of giving up and dropping out of the group, but so far they've been able to talk one another into sticking it out. For instance, one of the members, the one who'd had the article published, called me last week and told me she was on the verge of giving up because she hadn't sold anything in the months since her piece came out. She said in an Eeyore-like voice that she thought she could drink again safely now that she'd been sober for 7 years, and she decided that I could too, since I'd also been sober for 7 years. Her plan was to come pick me and Sam up, and then we'd drive around until we found a biker bar with childcare. I made sounds of empathy and reminded her that she'd been this stuck before. "Short assignments," I whispered. "Shitty first drafts." She mewled. I asked if there was anyone in her writing group who might be helpful. She said no, she couldn't call them. She knew they were all doing well, that they'd all had a great week, and that anyway they'd probably got together every few days without telling her and exchanged their favorite derisive stories about her and rolled their eyes. I told her to sit down and write about how she felt, and that maybe all her loneliness and paranoia would turn out to be great material. She said she wasn't paranoid. She just worried that all her friends got together in small groups and talked meanly about her. But right then, she got a call on the other line. It turned out to be someone in her writing group, who was also really depressed, and she asked me if she could call right back. Then I didn't hear from her the rest of the day. Finally, I called her back, worried that she was sitting in her car in the garage with the engine running and an old Leslie Gore tape on the stereo. But it turned out that the person who'd called her was really on the ward, really depressed. And he is a wonderful, beautiful, funny writer who was badly abused as a child. She deeply believes in him, so she gave him a rousing pep talk. And right after hanging up, she got back to work on her book. And she had, in fact, been working ever since, until I'd called and interrupted her. Someone to read your drafts. There's an old New Yorker cartoon of two men sitting on a couch at a busy cocktail party having a quiet talk. One man has a beard and looks like a writer. The other seems like a normal person. The writer type is saying to the other, "We're still pretty far apart. I'm looking for a 6-figure advance," and they're refusing to read the manuscript. Now, I've been wrong before, but I'd bet you anything that this guy never shows his work to other writers before trying to get someone to buy it. I bet he thinks he's above that. Whenever I'm giving a lecture at a writing conference and happen to mention the benefits of finding someone to read your drafts, at least one older established writer comes up to me and says that he or she would never in a million years show his or her work to another person before it was done. It is not a good idea, and I must stop telling my students that it will